A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He and Hannah have been living in small Jerusalem rentals for years, both running small businesses, and the apartments just don't have storage. He's got monitor stands, tripods, videography gear, the kind of stuff you need for work, but don't necessarily need every day. Getting rid of it isn't an option, since they don't have family in the country to stash things with. He's been eyeing professional storage, but always assumed it was wildly expensive. So the question is, for someone who's never used storage before, what should you know about getting quotes? What are the green and red flags when choosing a provider? How do you even inventory your stuff in a useful way? And are there options that cater to this exact use case? Intermediate-term storage for people whose apartments simply weren't built with storage in mind. And the real practical question, if you put your tripod in storage and only grab it when a job comes up, does that model actually work in practice?
This is one of those questions where the assumption that kills people before they even start is the cost thing. And in Jerusalem specifically, it's worth actually looking at numbers rather than guessing. From what I've seen, a small unit, think 2 to 4 square meters, which is basically a broom closet but vertical, runs somewhere between 150 and 300 shekels a month, depending on location and features. That's not nothing, but it's also not the 1,000 shekel nightmare people imagine.
150 shekels a month is roughly what people spend on streaming services and the gym membership they haven't used since February. And that buys you actual square footage you don't have to negotiate with a landlord for.
And the way Jerusalem rentals are laid out, it's almost a running joke. These apartments were built in the 1960s and 70s when the assumption was you owned maybe 2 suitcases and a menorah. No one was planning for home offices or videography equipment. So the storage problem isn't a personal failing, it's literally architectural.
The apartments were designed for a version of domestic life that hasn't existed since Golda Meir was in office. And meanwhile, you've got tripods leaning in corners and monitor stands behind the couch, and every time you need the couch, you're playing furniture. Tetris.
Let's walk through this systematically, because there's actually a lot to know before you even pick up the phone. First thing, when you're getting quotes, the number they give you is almost never the full picture. You need to ask about 3 specific things up front. 1. Is there a deposit? In Israel, many storage facilities charge a deposit equal to 1 month's rent, refundable when you move out with proper notice. 2. Is there an administrative or setup fee? Some places charge a one-time fee just to create your account and give you the access code. 3. And this is the one people miss. What's the notice period for vacating?
That last one is sneaky. You assume you can just leave when you want, and suddenly you're on the hook for another month because you didn't give 30 days notice in writing.
In Israel, where everything runs on a certain improvisational energy, some facilities are very casual about this and some are extremely rigid. You want to know which one you're dealing with before you sign. The other thing about quotes, many places offer discounts for paying quarterly or annually instead of monthly. If you can swing 3 or 6 months up front, you might knock 15 to 20% off the monthly rate.
Which brings up a budgeting question. If you're the kind of person who's been avoiding storage because you assumed it was unaffordable, you probably haven't built it into your monthly expenses. So the first step is actually looking at what you're spending now on the inefficiency of not having storage. How much time do you lose looking for things? How much stress comes from tripping over equipment? How much work are you turning down because your setup is too chaotic?
That's a real cost. People treat storage as an expense, but they don't treat the absence of storage as an expense. And for someone running a small business out of their apartment, the absence of storage is costing you square footage you're already paying rent on. If you're paying 4,000 shekels a month for a 2-bedroom and one of those bedrooms is half storage, you're effectively paying for storage already. You're just paying residential rent prices for it instead of storage unit prices.
Commercial storage is almost certainly cheaper per square meter than your living room.
So let's get into green flags and red flags, because this is where the physical reality matters. You're leaving your stuff in someone else's building. The number 1 green flag is climate control. In Jerusalem, summer temperatures regularly hit 35 degrees, and winter brings dampness. If you're storing electronics, camera gear, anything with batteries or sensitive components, you need a unit that's temperature and humidity controlled. Not all facilities offer this, and it costs more, but for videography equipment, it's non-negotiable.
What happens if you don't have climate control?
Heat degrades batteries, humidity corrodes metal components, and extreme temperature swings can cause condensation inside electronics. You might pull out a tripod 6 months later and find rust on the joints, or a monitor that won't power on because moisture got into the circuitry. For clothes or books, you might get mildew. For wood furniture, warping.
The cheaper outdoor accessible unit where you drive up to a garage-style door. That's for lawn equipment and patio furniture, not for work gear.
Those are called drive-up units, and they're great for certain things, but they're basically a concrete box with a metal door. No temperature regulation, often no real seal against dust and insects. For what Daniel's describing, you want an indoor facility, the kind where you walk into a building, take an elevator or stairs, and access your unit from a corridor. Those are more likely to be climate controlled, and they're also more secure.
Let's talk about security, because that's the other big green flag. What should someone look for?
At minimum, the facility should have perimeter fencing, gated access with a personal code, cameras covering all corridors and entry points, and individual unit alarms. Some higher-end places have motion sensors in each unit. You also want to ask whether the facility has on-site staff during business hours or if it's fully unmanned. Unmanned facilities can be cheaper, but if something goes wrong, a leak, a break-in, a lock malfunction, you're waiting for someone to drive over.
In Jerusalem, the concept of someone will drive over can mean very different things depending on traffic and motivation.
Another green flag that people don't think about, the quality of the lock they sell or recommend. Good facilities will either sell you a disc lock, which is nearly impossible to cut with bolt cutters, or they'll have built-in locking mechanisms. If a facility lets you use a standard padlock from the hardware store, that's not necessarily a red flag, but it tells you something about their overall approach to security.
What are the actual red flags? The things where you walk in and think, nope.
Visible water damage on ceilings or walls. If you see stains, efflorescence, that's the white powdery residue from water seepage, or any musty smell, walk away. Water is the enemy of storage, and once a facility has had leaks, it's very hard to guarantee they won't recur. Second red flag, pest traps that are full or obviously old. Every facility should have pest control, but if the traps are overflowing, management isn't paying attention.
Like checking the bathroom of a restaurant before you order.
Exactly the same principle. Third red flag, if they can't give you a straight answer about insurance. Your stuff is not covered by the facility's insurance. That's standard across the industry. They'll offer you insurance, or they'll require you to show proof of your own. If a facility claims your items are automatically covered, they're either lying or they don't understand their own policy, and neither is good.
What about insurance through your existing policy? Does standard renter's insurance cover off-site storage?
It depends on the policy. Many renters' insurance policies in Israel do cover belongings stored off-site, but usually with a sublimit, maybe 10 or 20% of your total coverage. So if you have 50,000 shekels of coverage, your stored items might only be covered up to 5 or 10,000. You need to call your insurer and ask specifically, does my policy cover items in a professional storage facility, and what's the limit? If it's not enough, the storage facility's insurance is usually pretty affordable, maybe 20 to 40 shekels a month for a few thousand shekels of coverage.
You're looking at maybe 200 shekels all in for a small climate-controlled unit with insurance. That's dinner for two at a mid-range restaurant.
That reframes the whole conversation. Now let's talk about the inventory question, because this is where people freeze up. You call for a quote and they ask what you're storing, and suddenly you're staring at your apartment thinking, I have no idea how to describe this pile of things in cubic meters.
The inventory is the part that feels like homework, and people who are already overwhelmed by clutter are not in a great position to catalog their clutter.
Here's the practical approach. Don't try to create a perfect itemized list. Storage facilities don't need to know you have exactly 3 tripods, 2 monitor stands, and a box of cables. What they need is volume and category. The way to estimate volume is to gather everything you plan to store into one area, even if it's just piling it in a corner, and measure the footprint. length times width times height in meters. That gives you cubic meters. Then add about 15% for breathing room and future additions.
Breathing room is important because if you pack a unit to the ceiling with no gaps, you can't access anything without unpacking the entire thing, which defeats the purpose of occasional access.
For categories, you want to flag anything that affects their logistics or pricing. Climate-sensitive items like electronics. Heavy items that might need a ground floor unit. Some facilities charge more for upper floors if they have to use elevators for move-in. Hazardous materials, which you generally can't store anyway. No propane tanks, no gasoline, no paint thinner. And high-value items that might need additional insurance.
A useful inventory for a quote call is basically about 3 cubic meters, mostly electronics and camera gear, some boxes of documents, nothing hazardous, I need climate control and occasional access. That's enough for them to give you a real number.
And if you want to be thorough, take photos of everything before you pack it. Not for the storage company, for yourself. If you ever need to file an insurance claim, having photos of your equipment in good condition before it went into storage is invaluable.
That's the kind of advice that sounds paranoid until you need it, and then it's genius.
Now, the question about providers who cater to this specific use case, intermediate-term storage for apartment dwellers without storage space. In Jerusalem, you've got a few categories. There are the big chains like Store It and Box It, which are professional, standardized, and have multiple locations. There are smaller local facilities, often family-run, which might be more flexible on terms but less polished on infrastructure. And there's a newer category of on-demand storage services that operate more like a concierge. They drop off boxes, you fill them, they pick them up and store them in a warehouse, and you request individual boxes back through an app.
That last one sounds like it was designed for exactly this use case, the I need my tripod on Tuesday, please have it ready model.
It does, and it's growing. The trade-off is that on-demand services charge per box or per item rather than per square meter, which can be more expensive if you have a lot of irregularly shaped equipment. Tripods and monitor stands don't fit neatly into standard boxes, but for documents, seasonal clothing, things that do box well, it can be very efficient.
If you're storing a mix of boxable and non-boxable items, you might actually use two different services. A traditional unit for the awkward gear, and an on-demand box service for the archive stuff you almost never need.
That's a sophisticated approach that most people don't think about because they assume storage is all or nothing. You can absolutely split your storage across different solutions based on access frequency and item type.
Which brings us to the operational question. The tripod problem. You put the tripod in storage. A client calls. You need it Thursday. Does this actually work?
It works if you design the system for it. The failure mode is when people treat their storage unit like a black hole. Everything goes in, nothing comes out until move-out day. That's not what we're talking about here. This is active storage where you're treating the unit like an extension of your apartment that happens to be a 10-minute drive away.
What does designing the system actually look like?
First, the unit has to be accessible during the hours you might need it. Some facilities are 24/7, some are business hours only, some have extended hours but not overnight. If you occasionally take jobs that require early morning equipment pickup, you need a facility that's open at 6 a.m, or you need to plan ahead and retrieve gear the night before.
Which means the facility's hours become part of your workflow. You're not just renting space, you're renting a logistical node.
Second, and this is the thing most people get wrong, you need to organize the unit for retrieval, not for packing. When you're moving stuff in, the natural instinct is to put heavy things at the back and fill every gap. But if you're going to be accessing things regularly, you need an aisle, even a narrow one. You need to be able to walk in, grab the tripod, and walk out in under 2 minutes. If you have to move 3 boxes and a monitor stand to reach the thing you need, you'll stop doing it.
Friction kills systems. If every retrieval is a 20-minute ordeal, you'll find excuses to not go, and then you're paying monthly for a unit you're not using, while your equipment sits there gathering dust.
Third, keep an inventory list on your phone, not just what's in the unit, but where. Tripod, left side, middle shelf, behind the softbox case. When you're in a hurry, you don't want to be playing memory games.
Updated when you take things out. The inventory that's 6 months out of date is worse than no inventory because it gives you false confidence.
Fourth, consider keeping a small go bag at home with the absolute essentials for a last-minute job. The tripod lives in storage, but maybe one small tabletop tripod stays in the apartment for emergencies. The full lighting kit is in storage, but you keep one portable LED panel at home. This way, storage handles the bulk, but you're never completely caught out.
That's the buffer strategy. Storage as the warehouse, apartment as the cash. It's how retail works, and there's no reason a small business can't operate the same way.
Here's a thought that might reframe the whole thing for people in Daniel's situation. If you're a small business owner working from home, your apartment is already doing double duty as both living space and commercial space. In most commercial real estate, storage is built into the equation. Retail stores have stock rooms, offices have supply closets. By renting a storage unit, you're not adding a luxury expense. You're completing the commercial infrastructure that your apartment was never designed to provide.
That's the pitch. You're not paying for storage. You're paying for your apartment to go back to being an apartment.
From a tax perspective, if the storage is for business equipment, it may be deductible as a business expense. I'm not an accountant, and Israeli tax law is its own special labyrinth, but it's worth asking the person who does your year-end filings whether off-site storage for work equipment qualifies.
Let's talk about the emotional dimension for a second, because the prompt hinted at it. Getting rid of all of this would be depressing. There's a real psychological weight to feeling like your belongings are a burden, and I think storage reframes that. Instead of your tripod being the thing you trip over in the hallway, it becomes the tool waiting for you in a clean, organized unit. The relationship to the object changes.
There's actually research on this, the difference between clutter you live with versus possessions you've intentionally stored. When something is in your living space but not being used, it generates what psychologists call visual noise. It's a low-grade cognitive load. Your brain registers it as an unfinished task every time you see it. Move that same item to a storage unit, and it becomes an asset you've deliberately placed for future use. Same object, completely different mental category.
Visual noise is a great term. The tripod in the corner is silently asking you why you haven't used it. The tripod in storage is patiently waiting until it's needed.
That's the practical psychology of the retrieval model. When you have to make a deliberate trip to get something, you only get it when you actually need it. It imposes a tiny friction cost that filters out the maybe I'll use this impulses and leaves only the genuine needs.
Are there any gotchas with the retrieval model that people don't anticipate?
One is that some storage facilities charge for access frequency. Not common, but it exists. Ask up front if there are any limits on how often you can visit your unit. Another gotcha is that if you're storing electronics and regularly moving them between a climate-controlled unit and the outside world, especially in Jerusalem summers where it's 35 degrees outside and 22 inside the facility, you're creating condensation risk every time you move equipment.
You pull a cold camera out of the air-conditioned unit into humid August air, and suddenly there's moisture on the lens.
The solution is to let equipment acclimate in its case for 15 or 20 minutes before using it. Or keep silica gel packets in your gear cases. Small thing, but if you don't know about it, you might blame the storage unit for damage that actually happened during transit.
What about the contract itself? Anything specific to watch for?
Read the termination clause carefully. Some facilities auto-renew on a monthly basis after the initial term, which is fine, but you want to know how to cancel. Ideally, you want a contract that allows cancellation with 30 days notice and no penalty. Avoid anything that locks you in for a full year with no early exit. That's a red flag unless you're getting a massive discount in exchange.
Does the contract allow them to raise the rent during your term?
Many contracts allow for price increases with 30 or 60 days notice, even during the initial term. Ask about the history of price increases at that facility. A place that raises rates 5% every year is different from one that surprises you with a 20% jump 6 months in.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the on-demand box services. Are there any operating in Jerusalem right now that are worth knowing about?
The landscape shifts, but as of now, there are a few players in the Israeli market. Boxit has been around for a while and operates in Jerusalem. They do the drop-off, pick-up, store, and return-on-request model. There's also a service called Store Stuff that's more focused on the Tel Aviv area, but has been expanding. The key thing with these services is to understand their retrieval fees. Some include a certain number of free retrievals per month, some charge per retrieval, some have tiered pricing. If you're going to be accessing your tripod 3 times a month, you need to factor those retrieval costs into the comparison with a traditional unit.
because a traditional unit where you can come and go as you please might actually be cheaper if you're accessing frequently, even if the monthly rent looks higher on paper.
The on-demand model is optimized for store it and forget it. The traditional unit is optimized for active access, different tools for different patterns.
To synthesize the practical advice for someone in Daniel's position, 1. Get actual quotes. Don't assume it's too expensive. In Jerusalem, a small climate-controlled unit probably runs 150 to 300 shekels a month. 2. Ask about deposit, setup fees, notice period, and price increase history when you call. 3. Look for indoor climate-controlled facilities with multiple layers of security, and treat water damage and pest issues as deal-breakers. 4. Estimate your volume in cubic meters by piling everything together and measuring, and take photos for insurance. 5. Organize the unit for retrieval with an aisle and a phone-based inventory. 6. Consider splitting storage between a traditional unit for bulky gear and an on-demand service for boxable items you rarely need. 7. Build a small buffer of essential equipment that stays at home so you're never completely stuck.
That's a solid summary. The one thing I'd add is, visit the facility in person before signing anything. Walk the corridors, smell the air, look at the ceiling, talk to the person at the desk and see if they seem competent or checked out. You're entering a relationship with this place. Your business equipment is going to live there. The vibe check matters.
The vibe check always matters. It's the thing spreadsheets can't capture.
On the psychological side, I think the real shift is recognizing that storage isn't a failure of minimalism. There's a certain aesthetic pressure, especially online, to own nothing, to live out of a backpack, to treat possessions as spiritual burdens. But if you run a small business, your equipment isn't clutter. It's capital. It's capital. Storing it properly is just good business hygiene.
The Marie Kondo approach assumes you're a consumer with too many sweaters. It doesn't account for the fact that you need a tripod to make a living.
Different framework entirely. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, the coronation ceremonies of certain Fang chieftains in Equatorial Guinea involved anointing the new leader with a paste made from crushed red camwood mixed with palm oil and powdered snail shell, a substance believed to chemically bind the ancestor's strength to the living ruler's skin.
Right. If you're sitting on the fence about storage, maybe just be glad your equipment doesn't require ceremonial anointing pastes.
That's the takeaway. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the facts flowing. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps more people find the show. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Go measure your clutter.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.